Hello, this is Kathleen, and today, Thursday, February 19th, I'll be reading to you from the Metro West Daily News. Framingham Bakery to Close After 109 Years by Caroline Bunnell, Framingham. It's not a rumor anymore. After more than a century as a local staple, Framingham Baking Company announced it will close its doors at 840 Waverly Street, Route 135, on Sunday, March 29th. In a February 17th Facebook post, the Italian bakery posted a photo of a sign announcing its closure. "This is the moment you've all been waiting for," the post reads, an apparent reference to online rumors several months ago that the business would close. Rumors that the Framingham Bakery Company quelled at the time. "Joan, Ernie, and Kathy thank our customers and employees for many years of memories," the sign photographed in the post reads. The family-owned Italian bakery opened in 1917, serving Metro West for nearly 109 years. Now operated by the fourth generation of the Thomas family, the bakery is known for its homemade pizza, bread, and rolls, all made from scratch daily. News of the closure has prompted strong reactions from both staff and longtime customers. Head baker Callie Bryant said owners had been weighing the decision for years, largely because they did not have anyone to take over. She joined as a baker in 2020, but has been ordering from the bakery since she was a child, and even had Framingham Baking Company's pizza and cookies served at her wedding. "I think the pizza has been everyone's parties," Bryant said. "From graduation parties, birthday parties, especially mine. Everybody loves the cookies and the platters." Lane DeLita, a Framingham resident who has worked at the bakery throughout high school, said she learned of the decision 2 weeks ago. Now a senior, she described the business as a fixture in the community and had planned on ordering from there for her graduation party. Something she said many high school students do. "Speaking for everyone in Framingham, it's an essential party food. It's just a pretty big staple," she told the Daily News. Since the announcement was posted, she said the phones have been ringing nonstop with customers asking if the closure was real. Customer Karen Koulopoulos said she visited Framingham Baking Company daily with her mother after emigrating from Scotland in the 1960s. Every morning, she said they would stop by to buy bread for the family. "This has been a part of our family for many, many years," Koulopoulos said. A longtime friend of the Thomas family, Koulopoulos said she had previously heard of the impending closure, but it's sad that a final decision has been made. "A lot of mom-and-pop kinds of businesses are no longer. And it's just very sad that places like this are closing because it's such a huge part of the fabric of the culture," she said. Within an hour, the Tuesday's post announcing the bakery's closure generated more than 600 reactions and 300 comments on Facebook. Shoppers World Owners Seeking Zoning Changes by Caroline Bunnell. Owners of Shoppers World in Framingham are seeking zoning changes to boost their plans to redevelop part of the iconic retail complex to include such features as multifamily housing, a hotel, and mixed-use development. During a City Council Planning and Zoning Subcommittee meeting on February 11th, Sama Kassem, Vice President of Development for New York-based Urban Edge Properties, outlined a proposal to establish a new Shoppers World mixed-use overlay district. Urban Edge, which purchased the property in late 2023 as part of a $309 million deal, says the change would add a new layer of zoning rules to the existing commercial zoning, allowing for a broader range of uses and development flexibility. Specifically, the proposed overlay district would permit multifamily housing, mixed-use developments, hotels, outdoor entertainment, cultural centers, research and development facilities, including laboratories, wholesale businesses, manufacturing sites, delivery services. The overlay district would be comprised of four main sub-districts, including the broader Shoppers World area, which includes tenants such as TJ Maxx, Public Lands, and Chipotle, one of which includes the AMC Cinema, a Massport parcel, and a parcel that includes the Kohl's department store, which is the focus of the proposed redevelopment. What the redevelopment plans include. The proposed zoning changes are intended to support plans to redevelop the Kohl's parcel and the Ring Road area. The project would convert 103,000 square feet of existing retail, including the Kohl's building, into 90,000 square feet of new retail space and 31,000 square feet of office space, along with 224 housing units. Framingham is ripe for this, Kassem said during the February 11th meeting. I feel there is a lot of pent-up demand for a newer product. Generally, the life of retail is 30 to 40 years before you see shifts, and I think we're in that 30 to 40-year cycle. Another major zoning change involves parking requirements. Framingham's current ordinance requires one parking space per 200 square feet. Urban Edge is proposing a reduction to one space per 250 square feet of retail space. Kassem said similar models have worked in other plazas as retail trends shift. City councilors expressed support for the zoning changes and look forward to moving forward in the redevelopment process. This is the future of where development is going and how space is going to be utilized. So far, so good. I like it, District 1 City Councilor Christine Long said. There is a lot of opportunity on that site for development and to reduce the paved surfaces and increase your housing, increase the retail, because that is the way things are going. District 6 City Councilor Phil Ottaviani said the redevelopment and zoning changes would give residents a more walkable upscale shopping and social experience. They've got an opportunity to really do something special at Kohl's and make it more walkable, he said. It's just something creative, but it fits. It'll give Framingham something special, and then maybe they can do more in the plaza. But the Kohl's site is a great start. No votes were taken on the proposed zoning changes, but the proposal is expected to come before the full City Council for a site plan review in the coming months. DiSoglio running for second term as Mass Auditor. By Margie Cullen from USA Today Network, New England. Massachusetts State Auditor Diana DiSoglio announced on Tuesday, February 17th, that she will be running for a second term where she'll be continuing in her efforts to audit the state legislature. I am running for re-election and ask for your support to continue working to increase transparency and accountability across the government, she said in a video posted on social media. During her first term in office, DiSoglio, a Democrat herself, has repeatedly clashed with Democratic leaders over her push to audit the state legislature. While voters overwhelmingly approved a ballot measure in 2024, giving DiSoglio the power to do so, state lawmakers have resisted. Most recently, she filed a lawsuit in the Supreme Judicial Court to force the legislature to comply. DiSoglio does not have a challenger in either the primary or general election. DiSoglio has, as the state auditor, since been elected in 2022. Previously, DiSoglio served as a state representative from 2012 to 2018, and then as a state senator until 2022. She was also a legislative aide. Before her time on Beacon Hill, she was the chief of staff for the Professional Firefighters of Massachusetts. She was also a small business owner and a nonprofit project manager, according to her website. The auditor is the chief accountability officer for Massachusetts. The Office of State Auditor, Diana DiSoglio, OSA, conducts audits, investigations, and studies to promote accountability and transparency, improve performance, and make government work better, the Office of the State Auditor website says. Through audits, auditor makes sure that the state entities are using tax dollars wisely and efficiently, according to the website. The auditor also works to address the impacts of unfunded mandates, which is a regulation that requires a municipality to perform certain actions without providing money for it. Despite the snow, Massachusetts is still in a drought. By Seth Jacobson from USA Today Network, New England. Based on the piles of snow, you might think we've had enough precipitation in Massachusetts lately, but it wasn't enough to curb the drought conditions in the state that have been ongoing since 2024. Drought conditions are still a problem in most of the Bay State. As of February 11, 2026, Massachusetts Energy and Environmental Affairs Secretary Rebecca Tepper declared the southeast region of the state has worsened to a level 2 significant drought, and the Millers River Basin has improved. All other regions remain unchanged. Here's what to know. What's the drought status throughout Massachusetts? According to the state, as of February 11th, Cape Cod, along with the southeast, central, and northeast regions of Massachusetts, are in a level 2 significant drought. Nantucket has been hit with a level 3 critical drought status, while the Connecticut River Valley region is only in a level 1 mild drought. The western part of Massachusetts has no drought conditions. Why are drought conditions so dire in the state? According to the Energy and Environmental Affairs, there still hasn't been enough precipitation in the state this winter. During January, Massachusetts received a significant amount of snow and a total of 2 to 3.5 inches of precipitation. In spite of this, precipitation deficits since 2024 remain, a statement said. Additionally, record cold temperatures and frozen ground have prevented snowmelt from occurring and soaking into the soil, limiting groundwater recharge and discharge to the streams. With the drought conditions, many water bodies are at lower levels and groundwater stores are declining. Wildfires have also been a problem. What steps should people take in a drought? During a drought, the state task force recommends minimizing overall water use and being particularly mindful of indoor water use. Following local water use restrictions, limiting or prohibiting washing of hard surfaces like sidewalks, patios, driveways, and siding. Fixing any indoor leaks from toilets, faucets, and showers, which can result in more than 60% of indoor water use. Monitoring total household water use shown on your water bill for sudden increases, which often indicate leaks. Conducting regular inspections of all pipes and fixtures, including those located in utility rooms, crawl spaces, and other hidden areas. Using a dishwasher rather than hand washing dishes. Run the dishwasher only on a full load. And reducing shower length. Modern tech helps and hinders Guthrie case. Tools assist authorities but can hide suspects. By Perry Vandell and Ray Covarrubias Jr., Arizona Republic and USA Today Network, Tucson, Arizona. The search for Nancy Guthrie is unfolding in the desert foothills north of Tucson and across digital networks where investigators are working to piece together physical evidence and electronic traces left behind by her possible abductors. Authorities say a masked armed individual was captured on video tampering with Guthrie's Google Nest doorbell camera. The FBI is handling ransom-related communications tied to the case. After officials released surveillance images, thousands of tips poured in within days. Deputies have executed search warrants, towed a gray Range Rover from a nearby parking lot, and confirmed they are analyzing unidentified DNA recovered at Guthrie's home. No arrests have been announced. Experts say the case reflects how modern crime and modern investigations now unfold simultaneously in the online world and the physical world. It's a game of cat and mouse, said Milos Manik, director of Virginia Commonwealth University's Cybersecurity Center, in an interview with the Arizona Republic. Manik said today's crimes often intersect with networked devices, cloud storage systems, and digital payment platforms. The same technology that allows homeowners to monitor cameras remotely or move money instantly also can be used to obscure activity or disrupt surveillance. Technology is changing, and as any technology can be used for noble purposes, it can also be used in nefarious ways, Manik said. It was not immediately clear how the ransom notes tied to the case were sent. Tucson television station KOLD reported that two ransom notes it received were not sent from the same IP address, a unique identifier associated with an internet connection. Manik said suspects could be relying on a different privacy tools, including proxy chains, VPNs, dark web, Tor networks, connection through burner devices, or local public Wi-Fi networks. Those tools can route internet traffic through multiple servers or locations, sometimes across countries. It may appear that it's coming from a certain city or a certain state or country, while it's really bounced all over the world, Manik said. Even so, experts said technology does not guarantee invisibility. Investigators also assess behavior and patterns. Lance Lacing, a former supervisory special agent with 23 years at the FBI's Phoenix field office, said he did not believe that the suspect was a professional criminal. He added that suspects frequently misjudge their own sophistication. A lot of times criminals think they're smarter than they are, Leasing said. Even when people think that they're covered their tracks, there's usually something that's left behind. The video of the masked individual tampering with Guthrie's doorbell camera shows the role Wi-Fi-capable home devices play in modern cases. These devices are networked together, Mannix said. You connect the timeline of events. Mannix said investigators can reconstruct digital timelines by correlating camera footage, device logs, and other metadata. But access to that data depends on storage policies, subscription services, and technical constraints. Homes and businesses increasingly use internet-connected cameras and smart systems, many of which store footage in the cloud. Video from one camera can be matched with footage from a nearby property or traffic system, helping investigators reconstruct movements with precision. However, what's theoretically possible in practice is not always possible, Mannix said. Leasing said reviewing surveillance footage can be labor-intensive when large volumes must be analyzed. It's manpower-intensive, he said. Sitting and watching 10 hours of video. I mean, that's one person's whole day. Authorities have used a device known as a signal sniffer mounted on a law enforcement helicopter in an attempt to detect Nancy Guthrie's pacemaker signal, according to reports from Fox News and News Station, who reported the device was attached to a Pima County Sheriff's Department helicopter, seen flying low over the Tucson area February 3rd. Kevin Smith, spokesperson for the FBI's field office, declined to comment on whether investigators were using such a device. Digital currency in physical crime has also become more visible, too. A Bitcoin address was listed in a ransom note connected to the Guthrie case. Cryptocurrency is often perceived as anonymous, but experts say its structure is more complicated. A blockchain is an open-source database, essentially a public ledger, that forms a permanent record of the transactions, said Nathan Peterson of the Schwab Center for Financial Research. Once recorded, a transaction cannot be altered or counterfeited. Every transaction is visible on the network, creating a permanent record of how funds move between wallets. But identifying the person behind a wallet is far more difficult. Finding the individual behind a Bitcoin address is nearly impossible, said Ken Gray, a former FBI agent and professor at the University of New Haven, in an interview with USA Today. Leasing said that when digital payments are involved, investigators often look beyond the transaction itself. They analyze communications, device data, surveillance, and other evidence that can connect online activity to a specific person. From the Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack to dark web marketplaces such as Silk Road, criminals have used cryptocurrency and anonymity networks to obscure their identities. In many cases, investigators later traced transactions and digital infrastructure. Crews continue search for 9 missing skiers by Janine Santucci, Siobhan McAndrew, Jaden Young, and Jason Hidalgo from the USA Today Network. Search and rescue crews on February 18th entered their second day of looking for a group of 9 backcountry skiers lost in an avalanche in California's Sierra Nevada mountain range. The skiers went missing on February 17th after the avalanche swept through the Castle Peak area northwest of Lake Tahoe at about 11:30 a.m., according to Nevada County Sheriff's Office. They were part of a group of 15 returning from a stay at remote huts just north of Donner Pass. Six members of the group were rescued after crews battled harsh weather conditions for hours to get to them that evening. Two were taken to area hospitals with injuries, the sheriff's office said. Originally, 10 people were thought to be missing, but authorities later upped the number to 9. The avalanche came as a powerful winter storm battered the region with heavy snow and high winds, the strongest winter storm of the year for Lake Tahoe area. Interstate 90 was closed over the Donner Pass, and the area received up to 30 inches of snow, according to the Reno Gazette Journal, part of the USA Today network. We are actively coordinating additional resources statewide to support avalanche search and rescue efforts to locate the missing skiers near Castle Peak, the California Office of Emergency Services said. Truckee-based company Blackbird Mountain Guides said the group of skiers included 4 guides and clients who were on a 3-day trip staying at Frog Lake Huts near Castle Peak. The group was in the process of returning to the trailhead at the conclusion of a 3-day trip when the incident occurred, Blackbird Mountain Guides said. The Frog Lake Huts are in the remote structures in an area known for being prone to avalanches and challenging to get to in the winter because of the rough conditions. To reach them, visitors must ski, snowboard, or snowshoe for miles. All routes to the Frog Lake Huts during the winter have some degree of avalanche hazard, according to the Truckee Donner Land Trust. Castle Peak is over 9,000-foot peak in California's Sierra Nevada range near Donna Summit and is a popular backcountry skiing destination. The Truckee Donner Land Trust advises all visitors to the Frog Lake Hut to carry a beacon, probe, and shovel in the winter in case of an avalanche. The risk of avalanches remained high on February 18th, and an avalanche warning was in place in the Lake Tahoe area through at least February 19th, according to the U.S. Forest Service Sierra Avalanche Center. Rapidly accumulating snowfall, weak layers in the existing snowpack, and gale force winds that blow and drift snow have created dangerous avalanche conditions in the mountains, the center said on February 18th. Natural avalanches are likely, and human-triggered avalanches large enough to bury or injure people are very likely. The center said the February 17th avalanche happened at an elevation of about 8,200 feet in the Castle Peak area. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you all have a safe and well day.